Really good to see you. If you're new here, we have teaching from the Bible every week. And over the course of this term, we are looking carefully at the book of Proverbs, which is in the Old Testament. It's about halfway through your Bible. And the way that Proverbs works is that it's really what looks like a jumbled set of different pieces of wisdom and counsel. They are not as jumbled as they look, and yet, and the way that they're kind of held together, or one of the ways they're held together, is that they present to us individual personalities, one after the other, and they come back round and round in a kind of cyclical way. And we're looking at different personalities over the course of these weeks. And we've got this week to the character called the sluggard. The sluggard. So we're looking at him or her this meeting. And so therefore we're looking at the subject of laziness or sloth, as we might call it. And that's kind of the theme of the message. I hope that it's helpful to you. Laziness is a problem that hasn't gone away in the 3,000 years since this book was written. It's a problem that every one of us will have had to deal with in some way. Maybe we fight against laziness every day in some shape or form. And what the Bible has to say about it is instructive and practical and ultimately liberating. So to start us off, we're going to look at a short film, which is a friend of ours in the church reading out some of the key proverbs that treat this subject of the sluggard.
The soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, while the soul of the diligent is richly supplied. The sluggard doesn't plough in the autumn. He'll seek a harvest and have nothing. The desire of the sluggard kills him, for his hands refuse to labour.
Okay, so when we talk about laziness and the sluggard, most of our imaginations will be taken to extreme versions, caricatured versions, kind of cartoon versions of the lazy person. And in our culture, we've been offered a few that are fairly iconic. Homer Simpson would be one example, perhaps. Peter Griffin, you know, just people that are in the movies or in the programs, just think people in the media that fill that box for us perfectly. The one who does nothing, the one who is comical in how little he or she does, the one who sends others out to do the work, the one who claims benefits and does nothing whatsoever, the one who the stoner who spends every little bit of money they've got, you know, skinning up and trying to avoid responsibility. And this is the sluggard, this extreme version on the edge of society. Thank goodness it isn't me, because what a shameful thing to be a sluggard. And yet when you look at the book of Proverbs, you get the sense that the writer is trying to get under our skin a bit and suggest to each one that we each, if we're not careful, have a bit of the sluggard in us. We each of us need to watch for this personality, this characteristic finding its way into our heart. And so it's more subtle than we might expect, and it teaches us to be on our guard, to be watchful, because sluggardry, if I could perhaps use that word, if I've just made one up, I'm not sure if it works, but we'll call it sluggardry. Sluggardry is kind of prevalent across life, across culture, more than we think. In fact, it gets into even our working life. It gets into our workspace. It gets into our offices. You don't have to be lying down at home watching daytime TV on your third can of special brew to be a sluggard. You can be a sluggard because basically you spend more time in any ordinary working hour in your office on social networking than you do at the tasks you've been asked to do. You spend more time on your phone, you spend more time texting, or not even more time, but just some time. Just any of your boss's time that you spend on Twitter or Facebook is time that you're being a sluggard. It's time when you're saying, right, this task, this responsibility, this stuff that I'm going to be doing faithfully for the person who I report to, who I respond to, instead I'm going to give this time to my own pursuits, to my own imagination, to my own distractions, to entertainments, to anything that will amuse me, anything that will take away the tedium. And that could be social networking. It could be just about anything. It could be just the variety of options that we have, not just on screens, but in conversations. It's spending way more time at the water cooler, way more time in the canteen, way more time watching YouTube videos of cats sword fighting with badgers. That, you know, that seems so very important to us at that time, because this is obviously very linked with the project I've been asked to do. We will find excuses, but we have to admit we're wasting time that is not actually at the essence of what we're going to be doing. And if we need proof that this is an issue for us as a nation, I submit to you the thing that came about in the news just a few months ago. There was a story of Westminster in the Houses of Parliament, and the 300,000 hits, 300,000 pornography searches on Google in the space of a year in Parliament. So this isn't just in our nation, this is in the heart of the nation. This is people who are, it's not just on company time, this is on taxpayers' time. This is the people running the place. It's time spent doing what I suspect are other things than what they're going to be doing. And I'm saying that to make the point. If this gets into the corridors of power, it probably gets in most places. Just general wastage, general time breezed away from the focus, away from the calling and the responsibility we're given. I came across a Gallup poll result very recently, taken from the States, but I suspect it's not that different over here. If anything, it may be worse. Our work ethic tends to be a little lower than Americans, in my opinion, but this is what was uncovered, that in the case of most company workers, it's said by this carefully constructed Gallup survey, 30% would say that they are actively engaged in the purpose and mission of the company that they work for. 30%. Of the remainder, it was said that 52% are disengaged. In other words, they're not really doing anything particularly. They're not effectively all that motivated about what they're doing. They're going in, they're claiming their paycheck, and they're going home at the end of the month having been to work. They've been to work. They drove in, they did the thing, and they drove home. But they were not engaged. They were not motivated. They were not helping consciously in what the team were meant to be doing. And then the final 18% were the people who were positively against the work that the company was set up to accomplish. So that's a little bit of a strange situation, okay? The minority are motivated, the majority are not, and a small minority of the majority are positively trying to take the company down from inside. And that's normal. That was a Gallup poll done from across the board. You've got to put that in kind of football terms for a moment. I'm trying to think what it would be like. I went to see Brighton play, and three of the players were motivated and working hard. I'm not going to say anything. They're playing very well this season. Last season, it might have felt like this. But imagine if there were only three, then five of them were kind of just chatting amongst themselves. And then two others were actually joining the other team, or like hacking their players down, or scoring goals in their own net. We would watch that and think, that's not a team. That's not good. They're not going to get promoted in a hurry, those guys. And yet that division of focus is not unusual, it would seem. It drifts into the ordinary working life of a lot of people. And it ought to cause us to stop and consider, what is going on here? What is it that explains this serious lack of drive and focus? What is it that causes people to not be motivated, to not want to work? What is it that causes people to be sluggards, whether it's at home in their vests and pants or in the office, kind of metaphorically in their vests and pants? You know, what is it that makes us so prepared to underperform and to be so uninterested and less bothered and less taken up with the agenda? There's a place in Proverbs that was just read out to us in chapter 13, verse 4. It says, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing. The soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing. I say that to point out that what we have here is to do with the heart. It's to do with the soul. It's to do with the desires that exist within the human heart. People do long for things. It's how we're wired. Human beings are created to desire, to worship, to long for, to want things. We're different than other animals in that respect. Animals don't have this kind of dominating sense of desire. They don't have that soulish, hearty sense of, you know, what do I want to get out of my life? But there's something about humanity that craves, and yet the book of Proverbs says that the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing. It's a horrifying prospect. And it's worth pausing on that as well to consider, why would that be? Given that desire would seem to be the engine or the trigger to get people motivated, to get people performing. If you want something enough, you will get it, right? If you want something, you will perform. You will achieve. You will try if you want something. And yet the book is saying the soul of the sluggard wants, craves, but gets nothing. And what's going on here? I want to suggest in the next few minutes that it's because actually our desires are not pure. They're not focused. They tend to be mixed. Our desires tend to be at conflict. Yeah, we might have a desire to work. We might have a desire to achieve, to accomplish something. We might be taken up with a longing to make our lives purposeful, worthwhile, and linked with a sense of meaning and direction. And yet we also have a desire to focus on this thing that just popped up on the screen, or this distraction, or this conversation. We have a desire just to have another 20 minutes in bed, just hit the snooze button, and I just have a desire right now that is kind of currently caning my other desire to achieve something with my day. And I'm finding in my heart this kind of mixed up cauldron of desires that's bubbling away. I seem to desire to achieve something, and I might hear a self-help, you know, motivational speaker. I might watch a TED talk, or I might read a good paperback on productivity and be totally zen about getting things done. And from now on, I'm going to be incredibly motivated. And then a couple of days on, I realize, this is weird. I've got these other desires as well, doing battle with this straight desire. And I'm afraid that's kind of part of our issue. That's part of our problem. There's a place in the New Testament that talks about the divided man, the person that is a double-minded person, a double-minded man in James chapter 1, who can't really make the call, who's never going to let one course of life dominate his or her focus, because we're kind of pathologically indecisive. And I'm afraid that's right at the heart, it seems to me, as I read this book, of the sluggard's problem, is this terrible failure to allow one thing to grow and dominate and become the focus. And so we allow ourselves to make crazy decisions, irrational decisions, stupid decisions. And Solomon spends quite a lot of his time laughing, mocking the kinds of decisions that sluggards tend to make. I suppose he's trying to use a little bit of shame to kind of get our attention. He says in chapter 26, verse 15, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish. It wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. Okay, now we've got used to, if you've been around the last couple of weeks, you'll notice he uses humor to make a point from time to time. This is exactly what he's doing here. You know, you're eating dinner, you're eating dinner with a lazy person. They stick their fork down it's just too much work to bring it back up to them. It's just too hard. I don't think I can do this. I wasn't even anticipating it to be a two-phase project. I mean, I put my hand down. I didn't expect to have to do more work as well. This whole food thing is going to have to wait. Now, it's grotesque and stupid, and it's stupid to make a point. Now, obviously, you know, it's not realistic, but he's saying the laziness that sluggards are shaped by is irrational. Do you get the point? If you don't bring up the fork, you can't eat the food. If you don't eat the food, you can't live. It's going to kill you. It's self-destructive. Laziness is actually really bad. It's destructive, and no one enjoys laziness. No one enjoys the fruit of it, and yet we still do it. Because our hearts are twisted and divided and irrational. What we desire is not necessarily what's good for us. And we know that it isn't good for us. We know it. The problem isn't even that we don't realize that being lazy is bad. Most people don't walk around, you know, being proud of being lazy. I know there's some kind of ludicrous versions that the tabloid newspapers like to rake up from time to time of, you know, weirdos who've been sitting in a sofa for 17 and a half years and haven't moved, and now there are mice living in their pants. And it's like the Daily Mail loves to kind of, look at this big fat man here. He hasn't moved for 17, and this guy's just a horrible picture of a poor guy with massive facial hair and just... And it's like, what a nutcase, what a crazy freak show weirdo. And this makes us feel a lot better because at least we're not him. Ugh. But here's the thing, that's really rare. Generally, friends, sluggardry covers itself up pretty well. It's funny to me that shame for laziness is actually quite high. People are more ashamed of laziness than they are over a lot of other vices. In fact, there's some of the things that the Bible says are wrong we're actually quite proud of. We do, and we think, look at me. But laziness, generally speaking, in most of our society, most of our lives, we try and cover our tracks if we've been lazy. You ever been in a staff meeting with people who clearly not done the thing they've been asked to do? You ever been in one of those feedback times where it's like the minutes from the last meeting and action points? And I think the action point was for you, Jennifer, to do the email. And Jennifer says, the email, yeah, we're doing the email. We're working on the email. It's in our, you know, we're thinking it through. There's some issues to do with the email, and it's kind of, yeah, it's an exciting prospect. That the project of the email, it's really got, and we're really excited about the email. Have you done it? Well, yeah, we're doing it. And this is the way we talk. If we're sluggards, we talk about processes and doing things rather than done things. How's it going with clicking the send on the email? Well, yeah, we're kind of considering the process and drawing up charts and discussing what might be done. I am good at this, all right? I have got clever ways of covering my back if I haven't done the thing I'm supposed to do, because the last thing I want to do is, no one does this. I've never known it to be common for people to sit in meetings and say, oh yes, I can explain what hasn't been done. The main reason it hasn't been done is because I'm plain lazy, that's why. Let's move on. It would save a lot of time, but it's so rare because we still feel a kind of stigma attached with laziness. It's a curious thing in itself. It's a shameful thing, but we still do it. We still pursue courses of behavior that we know are going to leave us with a sense of shame. That's why it says in chapter 26, verse 16, the sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. The sluggard's a crafty guy. He knows how to cover his tracks. He's clever. He makes it seem like his laziness is actually cleverness. Makes you feel like you're stupid. Have you done the thing you're supposed to do? I've known people like this, who when I've said to them, have you done what you said you were going to do? The thing I get back from them is abuse. As if I'm stupid for asking. As if they're really clever, and if only I was as wise as them, I'd know it was a silly task to have given them in the first place. I'm thinking, but you agreed to it a month ago. What's going on here? Sluggards are crafty. And I'm telling you this because I think we probably all are a bit. We probably all have to watch this tendency to cover our tracks, because the one thing we will not face is that we might have been lazy. That we might need to say sorry. We might need to step up. We might need to change and do what the Bible calls repent, because laziness is actually evil. It's a bad, bad thing, and it destroys. It takes away our dignity, covers us with shame, and it fills us with loss, horror. It destroys. The world is not set up for laziness. God, in his wisdom, made the world in a different way. It goes against the grain to be lazy. The lazy person is like someone who wants to go back into the womb. It's like you want to deny the fact you've already crossed the line. It's too late. You are in the world. You came out. You did the most important thing already. You came into the world. There's work to be done. There's stuff to do. If you want to go back to bed, that's like going back into the womb. It's like, I'm done. I want to escape. I want to avoid. I want to evade. And it's not an option. We're here for tasks. We're here for purpose. And sluggardiness brings on a kind of death. In fact, that's the very kind of phrase that Solomon uses in chapter 21, verse 25, when he says, the desire of the sluggard kills him. Kills him. It's horrible, isn't it, when you know you've not done what you wanted to do? Feeling of regret. I reckon every one of us, to some extent, can relate to that, right? I definitely can. Sense of horror at time wasted. Maybe years wasted. Maybe for some, a sense of life wasted, decades wasted. I have potential that I have squandered. I had people invest in me, who trained me, who gave me time. I have health. I was given all of this from above. If there is a God, he certainly gave me things to use, and yet I have squandered, I've wasted these things. That in itself is a frightening thought. It's a horrible thought, and it's a soul-destroying thought. You know the feeling, like some of you know the feeling of a whole day or a couple of days going by when you think, I wanted to get this done, I have a to-do list. And you don't get to scratch your to-do list, not even scratch it. And that in itself is yeah, it gets to me. I don't really like it. It gets to me in a bad way when I feel like I don't get the things done I wanted to get done. It really does something inside me. But some of us, we know what it's like to go through that repeated, on repeat for years. And you're looking maybe for the reset button. You're thinking, how I would live if I could start again. If I could just go back 10 years, or maybe just 5, or just 1. I regret so much. It's not a small thing. It's not a laughing matter. It's a horrible thing. It's a horror. A horror. And it's described in graphic terms in this book. In fact, you go back to chapter 5 of Proverbs, where it gets poetic, and the language it uses is quite poignant. This is right, I'm cutting in the middle of chapter 5, verse 9, where it's kind of describing the regret that a person might feel. Lest you give your honor to others and your years to the merciless, lest strangers take their fill of your strength, and your labors go to the house of a foreigner, and at the end of your life you groan when your flesh and body are consumed, and you say, how I hated discipline, and my heart despised reproof. I did not listen to the voice of my teachers, or incline my ear to my instructors, and I am at the brink of utter ruin in the assembled congregation. Do you feel the pain of that description? I hope you do. It is scary. The Bible is screaming at you in this place today. It's like, please don't go there. Never let that be your story. Let there be no one in this room and no one in Brighton who eventually has to say that over the course of their life. See how I despise discipline. I am on the brink of ruin. My life's gone down to destruction. We need to understand why is the heart twisted like this? Why does laziness con us and claim us? How does it get in? What are the doors we open to the poison, to the hooks? And I can think of a few that might occur to you as well as me. From the book, they're right here in the book of Proverbs. The one I'd start with is pride. It's kind of in here in the thing I just read to you. I despise discipline. I despise reproof. What does that speak of? Pride. It's really what it is. Laziness is often linked and caused by pride. Right at the heart of it, the cradle of laziness can be just sheer pride, aloofness, unwillingness to conform, unwillingness to listen, unwillingness to give up a sense of bohemian autonomy. No. No one will instruct me. No one will form me. I am utterly non-conformist. I'm from Brighton. I'm an entrepreneurial person. I'm a Steve Jobs. I do not need to follow the course that someone else has put before me. I am a beautiful, free creature. And I'm lazy. I don't really do anything, but I love my sense of independence. I love the fact that I can be my own master. It's just that I am going into utter ruin and destruction. But at least I am my master. And this starts early. This starts when we're kids. It started for me definitely when I was a kid. I can think of times when I was about, out of the sheer benevolence of my own kind and pure heart, to clean my bedroom. I'd say, right, I'm going to go and tidy my room. Why? Because I'm a lovely person. Because I'm a generous, delightful son who wants to please his dear mother and show her that he's a precious boy and he's got virtue stuffed into his heart. He's just a good guy. I wanted my mum to see how great and wondrous I was. As I'm going up the stairs to tidy my room, she shouts out at me, Joel, could you just go and tidy your room? All the motivation just drains away. Because suddenly it's not about me and my greatness. It's about just doing what I'm told. And I don't want to do that. I actually wouldn't clean my room under those circumstances. I'd be more likely to because I haven't been told to. As soon as I'm told to, it introduces this whole issue of conformity. I've got to do what I'm told. Well, I'm not doing that. Guys, how many of you, without raising your hands, know exactly what I'm talking about? I think most people in Brighton do. That's what makes this city tick. We will do everything except what we've been told to do. It's pride. No other word for it. Really, at root, that's what it is. It's just we're more important than other people's needs, other people's other people's comfort, other people's preferences. We're slacktivists. We like being active on our own terms. We like appearing to be active. We like being impressive. We have a generation of slacktivists. That's what millennials generally are, right? We're good at being activists, but kind of slack activists. We'll protest because things aren't going our way, but when it's like, well, what are you going to do about it? Oh, nothing. That's your job. It's pride. Second thing, fear. This is what he's getting at in chapter 26, verse 13. The sluggard says, there's a lion in the road. There's a lion in the streets. That's why I'm not going to work. That's why I won't want to finish the project. Because it's too risky. If I do that job, it's going to hurt. There's something out there. It's danger. What is it? It's fear. Many of us, friends, it goes back to this kind of womb thing. We want to stay in the womb. We don't want to come out. It's dangerous out there. We don't want to go out and do it. We don't want to find a job. We don't want to get a boss. We don't want to go to start at 9 o'clock, punch in at earlier, 8 o'clock. It's, the whole thing terrifies. What could happen to me? Or even his one that I struggle with for sure. I don't want to do things that aren't perfect. I don't want to do things where the circumstances aren't all correct. The wind's blowing in the right direction. Everything sorts itself out and finds itself. If it's not perfect, I'm not going to do it. And it's just fear. It's just perfectionism. It's unwillingness to trust that there's someone bigger than us, someone sovereign, someone in control over the circumstances who calls us to do tasks and says, I'll look after the situation. Fear. So pride, fear, impatience. We don't want to work because we don't really like the lack of glamour. We'll only do sexy things. We'll only do things that make us look good. Work involves long seasons of obedience in the same direction. Work involves doing things that don't look good for long stretches of time. The Bible uses the agricultural image a lot. It uses farming as the metaphor all the time. You sow and you reap. You sow and you reap. There might be a bit of plowing as well, but that's about it. There's just a few things and you watch for months. There's months of watching or not even getting a chance to watch because you're too busy tending all the other things. It's just busy, 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 and the results are slow. Nothing grows fast. Except cress. So if you want a job where, if you want a life where things come instantly, 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 this book is constantly reminding us that that's not normal, that's abnormal. That's kind of 21st century where you press a button and you get heated up stuff within a minute. That's not the world of the Bible. And frankly, that's not the world of the world either. That's not real. We don't get real results generally by instant gratification. We do get them by long seasons of patience. The real worker is the one who's able to withstand those seasons and press through. And that's why, again, the writer says in chapter 28, verse 19, the talks about the man who works his land and gets plenty of bread. And then the sluggard follows worthless pursuits and gets plenty of poverty. The sluggard is always thinking of get-rich-quick schemes and corner-cutting things and clever, clever, cute little tricks to avoid the patience issue. Just to get through quick. If I do this quick, do that quick, then maybe I'll get instant results. And maybe someone, you know, 25 years ago, it worked. Or they read a novel, they read a paperback, you know, and it worked. And it got some advice from some entrepreneur. And it worked. And really, but really, ultimately, guys, it's just another gambling scam. Because it worked for one person, it won't work for the trillion of others who are constantly distracted by the shiny objects of instant success. When really they should be wisely pursuing the less sexy, less glamorous, patient plodding path that gives good results, faithful results, healthy results in the long run. We need to be careful of the impatience issue as well, especially as a generation, I would suggest. So we've got pride, we've got fear, we've got impatience. Finally, we've got simply love of sleep. Love of sleep. We just love sleep. We love rest. We love comfort. And that's not wrong. We do. Comfort's good. The Bible's pro-sleep. Right? It says in the book of Psalms, he gives his beloved sleep. It's good. Sleep is good. Jesus did it Easter Saturday. You look at the Bible on the seventh day, rest, rest. It's written into the rhythm of life. It's just this consistent emphasis, rest, 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 rest. Get it in there. But you can do like you do with every other thing. Turn a good thing into a God thing and it becomes a bad thing. Do that with anything. Sex is good, so we make sex into God. What do? We destroy sex, we destroy ourselves. Money is good, we turn money into God. What do? We destroy money, we destroy ourselves and all the other people in our lives. Plenty of others as well. Rest is good. So we take a good thing of rest, we make it God. I must sleep. This is my altar. This is my place of worship. My bed is my shrine. This is my holy of holies. It's my inner temple, my sanctuary. I spend my days here with my laptop and my iPad and my Netflix and my magazines and my chocolate. This is a holy place where I have transcendent transport to other worlds of special spiritual sleep. And really, that's kind of hinted at in chapter 26, again, that passage where he gets to verse 14, as a door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. It's his place of worship, it's his altar. But the Bible also says in chapter 20, verse 13, quite a strong warning against this, love not sleep, lest you come to poverty. If you make this your God, it will kill you. Sleep is good, but don't worship it. Rest is good, but don't worship it. Comfort is good, but don't worship it. Some of you, the reason you're lazy is because you think that there's some almost unimaginable richness to be found in just indolent rest. If only I could just rest, then ultimately I'd be happy. And you need to be set free from that lie because it won't make you happy. It will actually rob you of your life. How do we get free from this? Well, I'm going to go straight to the answer because I haven't got time, and neither have you. I'm going to go straight to the answer. The answer, in the end, as with all of the areas in our life where we see destruction and death and wickedness and shame, is to go to the one who is able to set us free from all those things and to empower us to set us free, to reshape and restore us, liberating us for a new kind of life. That's what you need. You can do that in your own way if you like. You can just become that kind of self-motivated person. I will just turn it round. I will just read enough self-help books to overcome resistance. I will fight against this desire for sleep, and I will overcome it with my desire for achievement. A desire for success will dominate me. And that's an improvement, I suppose. But here's the thing. If you just go for the success and achievement as the antidote to laziness, my fear for you is that you go from worshiping at the altar of your bed to worshiping at the altar of other people's approval, at the altar of success in worldly terms. And friends, here's the thing. Even the greatest kind of success will ultimately prove worthless if it isn't eternal. That's why Johnny Wilkinson, the rugby player, the extraordinarily gifted rugby player, got to the point where he had such a huge crisis personally inwardly, because he said, the problem with me is that I'm on the top of the world, I'm the best in the world at what I do, but I am still only as good as my last kick. You can live at the pinnacle, you can climb the ladder and find out, I've set the ladder against the wrong wall. The thing I wanted to achieve is ultimately vanity. It's worthless. It's not eternal. It's not going to last. It's not meaningful. Here's the thing. Some people will succeed at things that ultimately destroy other people. Maybe they didn't mean to at first, but that's what they have to say at the end. Maybe you've come across stories of the great CEO, the great, you know, captain of industry, who kills it every year with the profits of his company. An amazing achiever. But look at his marriage. Look at his kids. Look at every other compartment of his life. Why has he succeeded so much? Because he's allowed these other things to be crushed. So success of its own is just another false god. It's a good thing. You make it a god thing, it becomes a bad thing. That's not the answer, friends. You can't just say, well, I'm going to turn over a new leaf and become an amazingly productive person. Even if you could, it would not be the answer. The only answer is the one who has eternal success at his disposal. The one who can give the meaning, the purpose, the focus of life. You could try and make one up. You could say, well, all I am is just an evolved monkey. That's what mankind is. We're just accidents. We're just bits of slime that managed to, by some freak accident, evolve into becoming humanoids. You know, here we are. We're kind of bipeds with a consciousness. It's all a consciousness is a bit of a trick anyway. It's not real. We're not real. But we've got to at least pretend that life is meaningful. So we adopt a child, or we get an important job, we go for promotion, or we buy a new house, and we try and make our lives seem meaningful. And I understand, it breaks my heart when people do that, but there's something so much better. There's actually knowing the real meaning. the person that can put you in touch with eternal purpose and reality, who would that be? Who could know? Who would have authority to speak and tell us what's our life for? What's it about? What are we here to do? Well, perhaps rising from the dead would be a clue. See, if Jesus has actually risen from the dead, and I believe with all my heart that he has, it changes everything, absolutely everything. You go back to that as your foundation. It's like a, you know, jigsaw or a crossword. Put that piece in first. Jesus rose from the dead. If you start with that, suddenly life makes a whole lot more sense. It actually does. It fits. It actually fits. And I start realizing life isn't even just about this passing age. Life isn't even about just getting more wealth, more fame, more popularity, being, you know, seen as more glamorous, more sexy, more impressive than the people next door or the people across the road or the people in the office down the corridor. Because in the end, there is an eternal criteria. There's an eternal evaluation. In the end, there's an eternal right and wrong, good and bad, false and true. And I get to have my life line up with something that's eternally important. And the way to have that is to meet with the person who rose from the dead, who can deliver us from death, deliver us from destruction, who can deliver us even from shame, even from regret. I know that when I talk about regret, there'll be many in the room who'll be feeling it, feeling a sense of, you know, failure, failed relationships, failed jobs, failed seasons, failed degrees, you dropped out of things, you split town, you left people, I'm just a failure, that's what I am. Here's the thing about Jesus, there's not a person in the Bible who met Jesus who he was intimidated by. There's not a person in the Bible who met Jesus who wasn't somehow shaped by the experience. You've ever met someone who's so full of life and authority that you never forget it. I've met someone like that. They said that about Jesus. When he finished preaching in Matthew chapter 7, it says, the crowd said to one another, no one has ever spoken like this man. And Jesus met the Pharisees. He met Pontius Pilate, the governor of his whole province. He met King Herod, a king. And he wasn't scared of any of them. He was totally in control. Totally in authority, full of focus, full of agenda, full of discipline, full of passion, desire in his heart, pumped away. I am going to do a job for my Father. I am living for something. I have a meaning to my life, and I'm going to share it with a multitude of people. People who met him, like his friend Peter. He wasn't called Peter till he met Jesus. He was just a fairly average, in fact, frankly, rubbish fisherman. Having a fairly ordinary life, you know, mending his nets most of the time, not catching any fish for sure. Ordinary guy, failure maybe in the world's eyes. Maybe you could relate to him, some of you. Just an ordinary guy. He meets Jesus. Jesus doesn't just give him a job, he gives him a name. Oh, your name's Simon? Not anymore. You will be Peter. You will be a rock. And on this rock, I will build my church. Peter went on to become one of history's world changers. Changed the world. Ordinary fisherman. Failure, perhaps. World changer. Why? Because Jesus met him. You need to meet him. You need to have your life caught up with his sense of purpose. You need to have your life dominated with his meaning, with his agenda, his task. You need to come into contact with the one who can tell you who you really are. Cause you to start flying and flowing and soaring with the gifts, the skills he's put inside you. Things that you think, oh, I'm quite good at that. He'll say, yeah, you're more than quite good at that. You're great at it because I made you great. You are my workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works that he foreordained that you should walk in. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead that Christ may shine on you. That's what he says to the sluggard. Wake up from your sleep. There's a meaning to life. There's purpose. There's a glorious purpose. Life's going somewhere. Why would you sleep? Why would you pursue pointless things? Why would you be too proud? Why would you be too fearful? Why would you covet rest when rest itself doesn't deliver as advertised? Twice says in chapter 3, verse 24, If you lie down, talking to the person who rests in God, if you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. That's what Jesus says. If you're longing for rest, life's busy. It's hard. Maybe you think, well, this is a message for lazy people. And honestly, Joel, honestly, I know I've got a watch for laziness. I know that I'm a weak person. I could get lazy. But honestly, that's not my problem. My problem is that I'm just knackered. I'm just tired. I'm just weary. I'm just stressed and stretched and strained. I can't find rest for my body, for my troubled mind. I can't find rest for my soul. And Solomon says, when you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Why? Because you found the one who gives rest. He says to the multitudes, he said publicly to the crowds, if anyone's weary or burdened, come to me. Come all you who are weary, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Work for me. I'll be your boss. I'll be your boss. You'll find I'm a different kind of boss. I saw a t-shirt years ago, had on the front of it, Jesus is coming soon. On the back of it, look busy. And it's kind of missing the point, because that's not what he's like. If you just look busy in front of Jesus, he'll be saying, why? You're supposed to work for me. I'll tell you when to do things. Rest in me first. Find him, find rest, and then find purpose. Find destiny. Find dignity. Solomon says, chapter 19, verse 23, and I'll finish with this. The fear of the Lord leads to life. Whoever has it rests satisfied. He will not be visited by harm. Do you want to rest satisfied? See, a sluggard doesn't rest satisfied. A lazy person never rests. They rest all the time, but they never, ever rest. They feel troubled, they feel shameful, and they feel their lives on a horrible trajectory of destruction. The one who finds Christ rests in a storm, rests in an earthquake, because they're going to the one who's uniquely able to provide it for eternity. You need to find Christ to find meaning, to find rest, to find destiny, to be set free from laziness.